Welcome to Intention to Treat from the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Rachel Gottbaum. Today, we talk about guns. In America, the statistics are staggering. Gun-related deaths are at record numbers, and guns are now the number one killer of children and adolescents. So what can doctors do to keep their patients safe? And what should they do?
My name is Bruce Patillo. My son, Christian, died at a friend's house from an unsecured gun when he was 15 years old on September 5th, 2021.
My name is Kristen Song. I lost my son, Ethan, at age 15 from an unsecured gun at his best friend's house.
I don't think we'll ever know completely what happened that night. What we do know is a family who owned three guns, at best lost track of one, at worst had given it to their son.
On January 31st, 2018, my son asked to walk down to his best friend's house. And unbeknownst to my husband and I, the father had four unsecured firearms, three handguns in a shoebox with the ammunition.
The gun had been taken out by the boy whose home it was. The gun was passed around. And at some point, the gun went off and Christian was shot from the upper left chest, just below the clavicle. I had literally texted with him, "I love you, kid. I love you too, Dad," probably 20 minutes before he was shot.
That day, my son, who had just gotten his braces off that morning, was shot in the head and had zero chance of survival.
When we got the call that night, we asked them what hospital they were taking him to. They told us Desert Samaritan. We knew that's a level one trauma. So they were bypassing at least two other hospitals that were closer. So we knew it didn't look good.
We didn't even park in a parking spot. We just stopped in the middle of the parking lot and we ran into the ER. And it was like the Red Sea, like they knew. And we walked in and there was like a collective hush.
When we arrived, they told us that the trauma surgeon was with him, that the damage was extensive. We were told that his chest had been cracked open and that the trauma surgeon was massaging his heart, trying to keep him alive.
I was stopped by a social worker who led me into a really tiny room where no good news is ever delivered and no sunlight ever hits it.
I prayed and I asked God not to take him. Just don't take him. And about 11:15 that night, the trauma surgeon came in and told us that he had passed.
The ER doctor, he came in and he was from my hometown. His child had been in school with Ethan and he slid down the wall and he put his head in his hands and he just whispered, "Your son is gone."
I wanted to see him that night. And the trauma surgeon, everyone recommended that we not. For me, it was a matter of not getting to say goodbye. And we never saw him again.
I begged to see Ethan. I was the one who brought him into this world, and I wanted to be the last one that I told the doctor I wanted to kiss his forehead and tell him how loved and cherished he is. And I wanted to tuck him in one last time as a mother. And the ER doctor would not let me. He said, "Your son is unrecognizable, Kristen. And if you go in there, you're never going to forget that." So he begged me just to remember Ethan as he was, getting his braces off at breakfast. And that was, you know, that's a decision that, you know, I don't know if I made the right decision. I feel like I didn't have closure. And I remember walking out to the parking lot with my husband
and turning around and watching the hospital doors close and thinking, my son is being wheeled to the morgue.
I mean, your whole world gets turned upside down in that moment. You're in disbelief. You're not, I mean, you never think those things will happen to you until they do.
My entire world imploded. And you can't even put it into words. The only thing I can say to people is, it's like holding your hand over a live flame and never being able to remove it. It's excruciating pain, you know, every single day of your life.
We were not a family that owned guns. We're not opposed to it. Our oldest son actually serves in the military, but we did not own guns in our home. And wrongly, we assumed that people who did have guns in their home properly secured them.
When the ER doctor whispered, your son is gone, we had no idea what had happened to him. And so my husband said, well, what happened? You know, we thought he got hit by a car. You know, never in a million years did we think that our child would have been shot in the head and killed. And he said, your child was shot in the head. And you could have, like, you said almost anything else besides that, and I would have believed you.
In the state of Arizona, there is no law against giving a child a gun to keep with them on private property.
After Ethan was killed, I realized that Ethan's death was not an outlier event, that this is the number one killer of our children. And the most common denominator is unsecured guns. You know, between suicide, unintentional deaths like my child, the school shooters, 76 to 80% of all school shooters use an unsecured gun from home or a relative's home. Can you imagine if those guns were secured? We'd have so many more children alive today.
I am here in Arizona. We are working to get a law passed called Christian's Law that would require all homes to properly store firearms when they are not immediately on that person or in use. Either using a gun lock or having it securely stored in a safe that is inaccessible by minors.
My husband and I, we fought and we passed Ethan's Law in Connecticut, which requires all gun owners to store their weapons if children under the age of 18 can gain access. I'm going to tell you, I've spoken to a lot of doctors, and a lot of them are really hesitant to bring up guns. My pediatrician's office has never asked me about guns. That was never a question in our conversations. They asked me if my children were eating like green leafy vegetables, but nothing about guns. And I think it should be just one of the questions. Do you secure your child in a car seat? Did you put a fence around your pool? Do you have working smoke detectors? You know, these are things that we're not asking to be intrusive. We're asking because we know that they were the number one killer of our children.
Doctors need to stand up and tell the stories of what they see every day in the trauma rooms, in the emergency rooms, and the damage it causes, not just to the people who are shot, but the impact it has on them, it has on communities. The reality is they are on the front lines of seeing the damage that this does, and those stories need to be shared.
This is Intention to Treat from the New England Journal of Medicine. We're now going to speak with two doctors who talk about guns in their practice every day. Dr. Hannah Sachs is editor-in-chief of NEJM Evidence and also co-director of the MGH Center for Gun Violence Prevention. And Dr. Francis Reel, He's a pediatrician and co-lead at the Center for Simulation and Research at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Dr. Sachs, I'd like to start with you. Give us a sense of why you started these gun violence prevention efforts at MGH and what your goals are.
We started this program of training clinicians to be much more competent about talking about firearms with patients because it's something that doctors just don't know how to do. Every year in this country, more than 48,000 people die from firearms. 48,000 people. That's right up there with the number of people who die every year from liver disease, for example, from pneumonia. And yet throughout all of my medical training, I'm not alone, all of my colleagues, I had not one lecture, not one conversation about what it would mean to bring trauma-informed care when it comes to gun violence prevention to the bedside. And when you map it with other causes of morbidity and mortality that we have a ton of lectures on, a ton of focus on in our training, it's just an obvious miss. And when we did focus groups, we did surveys, we talked to a lot of our colleagues, doctors in training, medical students, attending physicians, and it was very clear. Doctors were not talking to patients about firearms. And the reason was simple. They were not talking to their patients about it because they had never been trained to talk to their patients about it. If they did ask if there was a firearm in the home and somebody said yes, they had no idea what to do next. And for us, that seemed like a very solvable problem. And one of the real drivers for starting this work was the tendency that I was seeing among myself, among all of our colleagues, that there's such a learned helplessness when it comes to this issue. This issue is so big and it feels so overwhelming and it's heartbreakingly tragic and it is so personal to so many of us. And yet, because of how big it is, sometimes that can be paralyzing. And people don't know where to start. So as part of that effort to reject that learned helplessness, to take a step forward somewhere, we started locally and said, how do we better serve patients in the communities right here where we are? And that really revealed that there was this massive gap. So we need to learn how to teach this issue, talk about this issue across an entire spectrum of clinicians.
Dr. Real, you're a pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Can you talk more about this idea of learned helplessness from that perspective?
I work in a primary care setting, and I've had two patients that have died from firearms in the last year. As pediatricians, part of our job is providing families with the best advice to care for their children. And we don't talk about the thing that is most likely to kill a child on any given day. Firearms are their leading cause of death in children and adolescents. If you look at 2020, 4,300 children died from firearm-related injuries. So that is equivalent to 5 school buses full of children every month. But I think many of us feel powerless, that we don't have control or autonomy around creating change. But I think what we want to remember is that we are a trusted environment where families come for advice, for guidance, right? And so we should be giving them guidance on the thing that is most likely to cause injury or death to their child. But it's hard if we haven't had prior training on that, and that's what we are hoping to change.
So why bring doctors into something that is so highly charged politically?
So why clinicians? Because I'm a clinician. What I do day in and day out is see patients and take care of patients. So the question isn't, can somebody else do something to tackle this issue? It's, is there something that I can be doing better right where we are? There's no question in my mind that there is a clinical element here. When we're thinking about all of the counseling that we offer for patients, when we're talking about home safety assessments, for example, it's 30 to 40% or even more of all older adults in this country have a firearm in their home. So what does it mean that by 2050, there's going to be 12 million older adults with dementia that have firearms in their home? I'm an internist. I see adults. When I make a diagnosis of cognitive impairment or dementia, when you think through all of the counseling that naturally flows from that diagnosis, conversations about driving safety, about advanced care planning, about financial safety, when you think about all of those things that naturally flow, thinking about how to make the home environment safer for that older adult, of course, whether or not there's a firearm in the home that has been in the home for decades in the basement, of course, that's directly relevant to my patient's health. So instead of having the onus of why does this make sense for clinicians, I think we need to reframe that question. For clinicians who spend day in and day out talking about risk stratification, talking about safety in the home, how can you not address this issue?
Dr. Real, do you want to weigh in here?
Pediatricians aren't the solution, but we're part of the solution, right? So we are an environment where families come. It's a trusted space. We talk about home safety. We talk about bike safety. We talk about pool safety. We talk about safely storing medications. But so often we skip over gun safety, and I am someone who did that as well. I wasn't comfortable. I didn't feel like I had the right words. I didn't feel like I knew enough to ask. But what I have found through working with the Massachusetts General Hospital team is just not to be intimidated to get in there to ask the questions, because even though I'm not a gun owner, I have enough knowledge that I can provide families with advice to help keep their child safe, whether that's a curious three-year-old who's exploring their home environment or whether that's a teenager who's experiencing depressive symptoms.
So can you give me an example of how you begin to teach clinicians to have a conversation about guns?
So my prior work is training clinicians to practice communication in virtual settings. So the idea here is to simulate virtual encounters to give clinicians an opportunity to deliberately practice providing firearm safety counseling. So the way that we teach learners on how to introduce the topic of firearm safety is the first step, right? I think that's a huge barrier. It's just, how do I even say gun? How do I say firearm? And so we advise the three-step approach. The first step is embedding it within anticipatory guidance. So while we're talking about other types of safety measures that we're doing, we should also talk about this. So I might say, you know, I'm glad to hear your child's using an age-appropriate car seat. As part of my safety counseling for all patients, I also like to talk about firearms because we know those can pose a safety risk to kids as well. Then the next step is providing families some information around safe storage. So I'll say, what we've learned over time is the safest way to store a firearm is making sure that it's locked, that it's unloaded, and that it's stored separately from the ammunition itself. So then that leads into the third step, which is screening for storage strategies. As opposed to screening for, do you own a gun? So I might say something like, you know, I'm curious for your home or maybe other homes where your child may visit, do you know how the firearm is stored? Is it stored locked and unloaded? And so that's a nice way to give families that information around storage embedded within the normal guidance that we give and allow them to answer that question around storage practices. And then based on their response, you can then move into the counseling piece.
And the practice is really key. None of us think that watching one more webinar is going to be the game changer here. None of us thinks that one more clicking through the modules that we all have to do in our hospital systems every year is the way to make really durable, lasting change. But the opportunity in a safe environment to practice these skills, to develop your own language, to remember that the first time we all took a sexual history as clinicians, it was awkward and we stumbled our way through it. And then we got much more comfortable over time as we developed that language. This is right along those lines. Of course, there's more ways to do this. Whatever the clinical topic, we all have our own language, all our own approaches. This is just about how do you incorporate this topic into your natural clinical workflow. And we're doing it now because our medical education system has failed to prepare us for this need.
And again, the hope is that by talking about safe storage, by getting a family a storage device, that firearm will then be safely stored so that if a young child comes across it or a teenager makes a rash, impulsive decision, there will be a barrier to using that firearm. When someone's making a rash decision, a teenager, around something like suicide, that is usually made within minutes. And a barrier like a storage device that limits their access to a firearm can absolutely save their life. We have signs in every patient room that say, do you have a 2 or 3-year-old at home? Do you know that they could pull the trigger on a firearm? We have locks for you here. So we've educated our staff so that at check-in, they're asking about interest in storage devices. So I think that consistent messaging is really critical. The same way we provide positive, consistent messaging around vaccines, I want us to be doing the same thing around firearm storage. Let's normalize this conversation. Let's make it part of our routine care. And let's decrease the number of unintentional and intentional injuries related to firearms.
We think about harm reduction in so many ways in clinical medicine. So I think gun locks belong right in our clinics alongside bike helmets, alongside condoms, all these other tools that we think about that aren't a panacea for all of the injury that we see, but they're a step. If you're talking about an older adult with cognitive impairment that has an unlocked weapon at home, It may not be a storage device. It may be saying it's time to get that firearm out of the home. So really personalizing this conversation based on the patient that you're taking care of and the conversation that you're having is really critical.
Tell me about the response you've gotten from the parents.
When I started doing this, as I was working with MGH and trying to implement these skills into my clinical practice, my initial concern is that it would damage those relationships in some way. But I think what I have found is that it has really strengthened them, because the families I see, they watch the news, they are on the internet, they recognize the toll that firearms and firearm-related injuries are taking on children in our community and across the country. And by voicing that and sort of recognizing that that is an important part of my job when I think about them and their child's safety, and I'm bringing that up during a normal visit, I think it has enhanced the trust. They're not hesitant to talk about it. Like, it feels normal to them. It feels normal to me. As I've been screening for storage practices, families are transparent about their approaches. And some families will tell me that they have a loaded firearm in their household, that they wouldn't want to use something like a cable lock because it's really important for them that that firearm is loaded. And in that case, in the spirit of harm reduction, the safest way to probably store that loaded firearm is going to be something like a lockbox. So counseling the families on that, being able to provide them a lockbox that day, is, I think, a way that we can have impact and really, again, meet families where they are.
So Dr. Real, at your hospital, Cincinnati Children's, how do clinicians actually get this training on how to discuss firearm safety with patients and their families?
We have a sign-up genius that circulates around certain divisions within the hospital so that people can sign up for training. But on most days, I get emails from groups that want this training. And so we are working on building an infrastructure so that we can provide this more broadly. So thinking about how do we train more facilitators? How do we use automation and artificial intelligence to allow individuals to undergo this training in a self-directed manner so that we can more easily spread it around the country? So there is a desire for this training. We are working on trying to meet that demand. Our leadership at this hospital recognizes how important this training is and is investing in that. So whether you're in the emergency department, whether you're in primary care, psychiatry, we're going to be talking about firearms. And that's just what you expect when you see a doctor here at Cincinnati Children's.
So how has this work changed your outlook and how you feel about your work?
I don't feel powerless anymore. We're doing something to curb this public health crisis so that firearm-related injuries are no longer the leading cause of death in children. So I think some of the moral distress I was feeling around being a pediatrician at the number one children's hospital in the country, not feeling like I was able to impact the leading cause of death, was something that I was struggling with. But I feel like we can do something, that we have the ability as physicians to not be intimidated, to ask questions, to provide advice to patients and families across the age span, to have an impact in this field.
So Dr. Sachs, moving forward, what are your hopes for this work?
This type of training should be available to every medical student, doctor in training, and attending physician, nurse, others all over the country. And also recognizing how people have been touched by this issue, the trauma that they're carrying, the heaviness that they're walking through life with because of their experience as a survivor, as a family member of somebody who's been injured. All of that needs to be within the realm of what we do. So this training specifically, but really approaching this issue much more holistically, much more broadly, is right within what we as clinicians need to be doing every day.
Thank you both so very, very much.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel. Really appreciate the opportunity to bring some visibility to this really important topic.
Thanks, Rachel. Great to be here and look forward to continuing this conversation.
Dr. Hannah Sachs is co-director of the MGH Center for Gun Violence Prevention and also editor-in-chief of NEJM Evidence. And Dr. Francis Real is a pediatrician and co-lead for the Center for Simulation and Research at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. We had help from our managing editor, Deborah Molina. Our engineer is Mike Toda. This is Intention to Treat from the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Rachel Gottbauer.